welcome. This is Dr. Dawn Motika, and you're listening to Ask Dr. Dawn. In the next hour, we'll be discussing healthcare and science in the news. We'll be taking your calls and also replying to your emails. So I hope you'll stay tuned. We may have a special guest later in the program. I've got my fingers crossed. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, last week I ran a pre-recorded program because I was at a most fascinating functional medicine conference that was all about the immune system, particularly with reference to autoimmune diseases and functional medicine ways of addressing it. So let me start by just defining an autoimmune disease. I think if we define it properly, then we'll be able to understand it better. So I'm going to define an autoimmune disease as self-directed tissue inflammation, and it results from the loss of tolerance by an aberrant dendritic cell, a beta or a T cell response that develops immune reactivity towards native or self antigens. So that's, I'm getting a little technical there in the language, but let's walk through it and I think you'll understand. If you really stop and begin at the beginning, all cells have glycoproteins, which are protein and sugar molecules, on their surface. And I like to think of those as barcodes, just like the barcodes that you might run your cell phone over to get information. These barcodes give information about that cell, about its lineage. What kind of cell is it? Who does it belong to? Does it belong to a mammalian cell line? Does it belong to a bacterial cell line? It's really got a lot of information on the surface of any cell. And in the course of development, you think about embryologic development, we start out as a single cell. And as our cells begin to divide and express different DNA, different phenotypes, as we say, some genes are turned on, and those turned on genes produce glycoproteins, which are then displayed on the surface of the cell, saying, I'm a proto-kidney cell, I'm a kidney stem cell. And if I were a kidney stem cell, I'd be in the middle layer, a mesenchymal layer of the three-layer little planarian worm that we are at about this stage in embryologic development. And I'd be heading for the middle of the body, the central axis, and I'd be starting to look for other cells that were going to be nerve cells that would innervate my kidney. And we actually have an email about that and a story later. But I'd be carrying those labels, looking for the right cells, and I'd use those to hook up with the correct cells. Having done that, they would stimulate me, the proto-kidney cell, and I would stimulate them, the proto-nerve cell, and we would co-evolve into a kidney, a functional kidney. And then epithelial cells would come along, and they would form the ureter. And it is rather amazing that it all happens. It's astonishing, actually, that it happens correctly 96% of the time. But it does, in humans at least. Wow. So we've got to have those cell surface markers. And later on in the course of development, there is a organ in the chest called the thymus. And when children are born, it's very large. It shrinks throughout our life. But one of the purposes of the thymus is to take immune cells that have formed against self antigens and destroy them, turn them off, in other words. So the thymus is very important in downregulating the natural immune response that I'm about to talk about to prevent us from having autoimmune clones all over the place, because otherwise, as part of the natural process of development, we would all have 1,000 different autoimmune diseases because our bodies would be reacting to our own tissues. But that doesn't happen. So an autoimmune disease is a malfunction of this very sophisticated system in which we lose that thymus-generated downregulation of the T-cell clones. We get new clones of T-cells which are actively stimulated to attack one or more of the barcodes on our body surface. Let's start at that point. In these cells, they're called dendritic cells most commonly, and they have nothing to do with brain cell dendrites, so I need to separate that. These are dendritic cells, and they are part of the immune system. They're amoeba-like cells, which swallow anything that comes along, any cell that comes along. They'll actually swallow it, break it up, extract the cell surface glycoproteins, and under certain circumstances, display them on the surface on little dendrites, little pincushions, like a sea urchin that stick out, and wave the protein around and say, hello, T cells, any immature T cells here who'd like to become sensitized? Because we have in our body at any given moment, thousands, millions of T cells that are virgin T cells. They haven't been trained to attack anything yet. And they're just waiting for a dendritic cell to wave something in their face. And they circulate in the body tissues and in the lymph tissues and in the interstitial tissues. There are millions of them in the intestinal tissues immediately below the intestine, because that's where a lot of the antigens and, as far as that goes, the pathogens that we encounter in our daily life are going to be coming into the system. They're also in the skin for exactly the same reason. You cut yourself, stuff can get in. Now, back to the dendritic cell. The dendritic cells only display the glycoproteins if they're getting a danger signal. So they encounter something they haven't seen before, they chew it up, and then they say, is there evidence of danger? And in the case of danger, we're talking about breakdown products of cells. So for example, if you have inflammation, then the chemical signals of inflammation are read by the dendritic cell as danger. So they will say, okay, whatever glycoprotein barcodes I've got, one of them might be associated with this cell injury, this tissue injury. So I'm going to display those and call in some T cells to attack it. So you might, for example, have a situation where you have a cut and that's going to release chemical cytokines. And so any new stranger antigens that show up in that cut are going to get displayed on dendritic cells. Make sense? Seems like a pretty good safety mechanism to me. It's almost like the dendritic cell was a police sergeant at the dispatch desk who's sending out patrol cars to check on something that looks like there might be a problem. So, hey, there's cell damage and I've got this antigen I haven't seen before. So we got a stranger and we got a burglar alarm. Let's send a car out to check that out. So it's stranger plus danger in order to activate the immune system. So after the dendritic cell displays these things, they're floating around. It also releases chemokines, which are chemicals that call in the T cells, call in those virgin T cells. Hello. T cells come along and they are stimulated by the dendritic cells to start attacking, looking around and attacking anything that has that barcode on it. At the same time, the dendritic cell says, I don't want this to get too far out of hand, so I'm going to create a T suppressor clone that will damp down this reaction so that it doesn't get too far out of hand. And one of the types of innate immune system flaws that can be inherited is a tendency not to make a very effective clone of T suppressor cells. So whenever the T cells get stimulated, there's no one around to say, hey guys, cool it, calm down, you've gone far enough. Now the T cells go off and they stimulate the B cells. And B cells are the ones that form circulating antibody. So these circulating antibodies are, well, immunoglobulins, and they come in multiple flavors, IgA, which is secreted in your saliva and in your intestines, and is very implicated in celiac disease, IgG, which is basically everywhere in your body, including your bloodstream, but also in your lymph tissue, which effectively means everywhere in your body, IgE, which is made by beta cells and then distributed to the mast cells, which are other amoeba cells that live in your respiratory and intestinal epithelium. And those mast cells are where allergies and hay fever and rhinitis come from. And goodness knows, with that rain, sun cycle that we've been having lately, we've got a lot of rhinitis happening. This is also how vaccinations work, by putting in a danger signal called an adjuvant and a stranger signal, which is the thing that you're trying to get the immune system to fight, and you inject that into the arm, right where it can be evaluated by dendritic cells. And the dendritic cells say, oh, stranger plus danger, I'm going to display that. And the importance of this is that when you make a vaccination, the vaccination is only as good as the danger signal. So you can put tons of stranger in there, but if you don't have a danger signal generated at the same time, you won't get a good take on the vaccine. On the other hand, if you put too much danger signal in, you get an overreaction to the vaccine and you make people very sick because you trigger the innate immunity, which can be triggered by just the danger signal all by itself. So it is an extremely complicated process. And over the next few weeks, I'll be addressing autoimmune disease in more detail and talking about how important it is to have that stranger danger signal and how if we remove the danger signal by natural therapies, even stress reduction, because stress itself is a danger signal to the immune system, we can have a profound effect on autoimmune disease and its progression. Now, one last word about autoimmune disease. All of the disease-modifying agents that are currently offered, these expensive monoclonal antibodies that attack tumor necrosis alpha, all of these drugs are happening at the very, very far end of this cycle. They're all the way at the T cell that is now attacking the antigen. If we can target our therapies upstream, we can have a much more effective and generalized effect on the immune system and do a lot less damage to the cancer surveillance system. The cancer surveillance system is definitely impaired by our current drug therapy for autoimmune disease. And we'd really rather not do that for obvious reasons. Now, we have added a button to the main webpage at Ask Dr. Dawn that will let you follow me on Facebook. Later today, we'll have one that will let you follow me on Twitter. Over the last couple of weeks, I have been flexing my fingers on these websites, and I have been publishing a series of short blog posts at the Facebook website. In any event, I am very appreciative of your comments and feedback on the Facebook site. I am looking to make this a useful adjunct to the Ask Dr. Dawn podcast and radio program. And for that, I need my consumers and my listeners to feed back to me. We have on the line my very dear friend who is a physicist is going to have a brief conversation with us about radiation, which has been very much in the news. So let me welcome Duff from Felton. Hello, Duff, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Doing real well. Thank you.
I guess you're ready to talk with us. Can I out you and give your last name, or would you rather remain just...
Oh, go ahead.
Okay, this is Mr. Duff Howell, who is a Stanford-trained physicist and a dear friend of mine, and we're going to talk about radiation, which we've been doing a little bit lately because I've been needing to go to Duff as my go-to guy for a little bit of a reminder of physics. So, Duff, how about some basic physics about radiation, and should we be worried about trace amounts of radiation found in milk in California, because everyone is freaking out here?
Sure. I'll make the same caveat like you do at the beginning of the show. I am a doctor of physics, but not of health physics, so some of what I'm going to say would be opinion and not a substitute for a trained person in that field. But radiation is a word that is kind of like bandwidth. It means a lot of different things depending on the context. For these nuclear power plants and things like that, radiation at the very low level is something coming in with a lot of energy. There's what they call sort of high energy radiation and low energy. Low energy is mostly heat. High energy is when something hits something else hard enough to start breaking bonds. Bonds are what make the molecules that make up your body, that make up wood, that make up shielding, make up anything. So in a nuclear reactor, one of the reasons it's surrounded with water is that it's very hard to do much damage to water. You break it apart and it forms right back together, and it carries the heat away when it does that. But you can have two basic parts. There's radiation, which is light, X-rays or gamma rays, that are very high energy photons. That's kind of the energy side of it. And you can also have radiation, which is particles. And most particles in a nuclear reaction are from radioactive materials, and that means that it's something which will split apart spontaneously or much more quickly if there's more radioactive material around. That's the critical mass idea.
So those are neutrons and protons.
Neutrons, protons, electrons, the primary things you worry about with emissions are what they call electrons are the big part because the books have to balance at the atom and molecule level. You have to conserve momentum, you have to conserve energy always. And so an electron gets dumped off because a particle or a photon has come by and knocked it loose, it's got to go somewhere. And charge, the electrostatic attraction at that distance, it's not like, you know, raising your hair up on a comb on a dry day. It's, you know, orders of magnitude more powerful than gravity. So that electron is sitting there with charge, and you talk about it on the show, free radicals. That's the whole idea, that you've got charge around and it starts mucking up all those nice, lovely organic structures in your cells.
Like the double helix in your DNA.
Exactly. And so you have this charged particle, and you knock an electron loose, you've also got an atom or a molecule that's got excess charge on it too. And so it's like, you know, having this lovely, you know, tray of marbles, and then you go and try to shove one more in, and what happens is that something's got to give. So that charge is unbalanced, something else pops up somewhere else, and you can get cascade effects. So it's not just that you break one bond in that little DNA helix, but you break one, and that makes something else shift, and then another one breaks, until something eventually kind of balances out. And so the electron can do that. Another usual product from these atomic decays are what are called alpha particles. That's the nucleus from a helium atom, or the equivalent, and that's also got a lot of charge to it and a little more momentum to it. And so when those hit, whether it's a photon doing it or a piece of atomic nucleus doing that or an electron, the effect is the same, is that you've got these nicely built structures, the molecules that are DNA or other parts of your body, and you are going and sort of randomizing something. You're breaking a bond, and often it's not just one, but many of them, and you can call that mutation, or you can call that killing. I can't speculate on all the biochemical effects.
Well, let me put pause on there for just a moment.
Sure.
And step in and say that exactly what happens is based on evolution. We have cosmic rays and other ionizing radiation that occur naturally, and our cells have evolved mechanisms for dealing with it up to a certain dose. One of the things that happens is that cell division is actually put on hold, and repair enzymes go in and fix the DNA. And once the DNA is fixed, they give a thumbs up sign to the mitotic apparatus, and those cells start dividing again. If you can't fix the DNA because there's just too much damage, then what's supposed to happen, and happens 99.9999% of the time, is that the cell says, okay, bye-bye, I gotta die, and commits suicide because it's too badly damaged to be allowed to self-perpetuate. And so up to a certain dose, all of us can handle this. And there are things that we can do, like having a lot of antioxidants in our diet, that because these antioxidants are floating around and grab the free radicals before they get to the DNA, it reduces the amount of damage. And I have a related article about that. So it's when the dose of radiation gets to a point where we overwhelm the cellular repair mechanisms that
exactly.
We get into trouble. And if it's massive, like one of those workers who got a massive radiation dose, so many cells of your body die at the same time that it kills you. So you die of the cell death, which is actually a protective mechanism because it's so massive.
Mm-hmm.
If you survive that radiation, then you may die 10, 15, 20 years down the line from a cancer that was induced by overwhelming the cell repair mechanism, but not so much that the cell death killed you in the first place.
Exactly. And for radiation, you know, the same kind of thing can happen. Is you can get an acute toxic dose because somebody trying to work getting the reactor coolant started again. Or, say, if you live in an area that has high background radiation, whether it's accumulating radon or it's, you know, you're in a contaminated zone because you're only a couple miles from the Chernobyl reactor or something, then you can accumulate it. And it's the same sort of idea of, you know, you don't eat more than a certain amount of certain fish over time because you may be accumulating mercury. And that mercury is all spread in the environment, but there are accumulation points. And so when you mentioned milk, you know, there's radioactive particles which have been expunged from the reactor basically as an aerosol as water vaporizes, and it can carry some of these heavy radioactive particles with it. And once that happens, they can be carried along in a jet stream or along in water. And fall as rain, the grass can concentrate the rainwater into the grass. The cow can concentrate the grass into its body and into its milk. But you're still looking at something. If they get this kind of cleaned up in the near future, you might have enough accumulated radioactive particles to give you, you know, in a couple extra days in Denver or something like that. And, you know, radiation is not good for you, but you have to give some credit to your body's natural defense and repair mechanisms, like you mentioned. Now, if you're a couple miles from that plant, you know, I would certainly not want to just keep, you know, drinking local milk from there, because the levels are probably a lot higher. If you're really concerned about things like, you know, getting into your water here, if you're on well water, the ground will probably do an awfully good job of pulling those particles aside. It's like a giant carbon filter, in essence. Likewise, you know, you get yourself a Brita filter or something like that, or a reverse osmosis filter, you will take those particles out just like a lot of the other stuff that you don't like the taste of. So there's prudent, simple things that you can do. I don't really know that at this point going and getting these iodine chelation kits that are in some of the stores for $20 or $30 or $50 is probably a little bit of an overreaction right now, I think.
Well, I agree with you completely. And we had an email, actually, from Barry in Capitola on exactly this topic. And he wanted to know what he could do to minimize the effects and if I recommended taking potassium iodide. And the time that I would say to take potassium iodide is if we have a massive mushroom cloud explosion at the Japanese reactor, which is very, 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 very unlikely. But if that happened and a large amount of radioactive iodine got into the jet stream, you could debatably say that it might make sense to take 30 milligrams of potassium iodide the day that that stuff makes groundfall in your area. That's a very unlikely scenario, and the fact is that the protection from the potassium iodide only lasts 24 hours, so you have to do it again in another 24 hours until the levels drop. So doing it now is counterproductive, really, because this stuff is toxic, and it is toxic in accumulated doses. A single 30-milligram dose is not toxic, but if you do that every day for, say, 10 days, you're going to get into trouble.
Exactly so. And one of the things to also emphasize is that the primary danger on these sorts of things is getting the radiation-emitting substances lodged in your body, usually, you know, either by breathing it or by ingesting it, or, you know, for food or liquids. Outside, through most radiation training classes, what they talk about is that the, you know, the helium nuclei or the other particles that are emitted by radiation, usually those are stopped by the equivalent of like a sheet of paper. So, you know, you have clothes on and there's a little radiation going by in the air and it emits something, your clothes will probably stop it. The dead surface of your skin layers will stop it. And it's not something to worry about, again, unless there is an acute, very local radioactive event. Something that's across the ocean, sort of, as you said, a very unlikely, you know, you'll hear about it in the news 24/7 explosion. It's not the kind of accumulation of radiation-emitting particles, things with half-lives, that you need to be spending a lot of time worrying about. I mean, don't ignore it and watch the news, but also, you know, take a deep breath and be rational about it and put it against what happens just going outside, even on a cloudy day. There's a lot more radiation hitting you just coming out of the sky than is coming out from the iodine that's made its way across the ocean.
Thank you, Duff. You've been a breath of fresh air, non-radioactive, I might add, and have a great afternoon.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Duff.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So you've been listening to Duff Howell, a friend of mine, talking about radiation, and I wanted to just follow up or wind up with something from the Life Extension website, 32911, about protection of the body from the radiation of CTs. And these researchers were just doing a proof of concept study. It was announced at the Society of Interventional Radiology's 36th annual scientific meeting, because if you're in interventional radiology, that means you're subjecting people to fairly high doses of radiation. And the question is, are you getting into a situation where your very well-meaning CT scans every 3 months for the cancer patient are actually subjecting them to an overwhelming risk of radiation that their cellular repair mechanisms might be overwhelmed? And of course, I mentioned earlier the antioxidants, which are acting out like catcher's mitts or magnets to pull those free radicals out of the chain reaction that Duff was talking about quickly, so that they don't have an opportunity to damage the cells. vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin A, vitamin D. These are all free radicals. The flavonoids that are found in fruits and vegetables, the concept of the rainbow diet, this all increases your free radicals. So one of the things you can do to protect yourself against the detectable but admittedly very low levels of radiation that are out there is simply to eat more fruits and vegetables and take some vitamin C, maybe a 500 milligram pill daily. Certainly that would be plenty. What Dr. Murphy, this is Kieran J. Murphy, who, as I said, announced this finding at the 36th annual scientific meeting in Chicago of the Interventional Radiology Society, was they took blood samples, probably from those lab rats we call graduate students, and they administered gamma radiation to them, which would be similar to what was found in a CT scanner, and they looked at DNA damage. Then they used higher and higher concentrations of ionizing radiation. When the subjects were given vitamin C, glutathione, and uric acid for 5 days, during which blood was drawn daily, and then they irradiated the blood and measured the amount of DNA injury, they found a significant decrease in the DNA damage in people who had been pre-treated with oral doses of these substances. Now, glutathione orally is actually very difficult to get into the bloodstream. So if I'd been a consultant on this study, I would have said to use N-acetylcysteine, NAC, which is available in any health food store. The point is, this is hard data, very well designed scientifically, to show that that DNA damage can be reduced. So if you want to do something good for yourself, don't buy potassium iodide. Buy a bunch of navel oranges and eat one every day. Organic if possible. We're going to go to an email. This one was from Lexington, Kentucky. I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's quite long, but just to extract it, Marie was about 145 pounds at 5'2" in middle school and began exercising. And so by her senior year in high school, she weighed about 125 pounds. Then by her senior years of college, about 120 pounds. She gradually lost weight, although she isn't over-exercising. But when she weighed about 125 pounds and was jogging for 5 days a week, her periods stopped. So she was given Provera by the school nurse, and that proved that she did have functioning ovaries at the time. She got a period. They checked her estrogen, told her he was okay. Eventually, they'd had an MRI of her pituitary. That was to look for a prolactinoma, which is a pituitary gland tumor that secretes the hormone prolactin, which will shut down the periods. And off she went to graduate school, never really gave it too much thought. She says, I've always had bouts of fatigue, always worse in the winter, and random aches and pains with brain fog and moderate depression. It's sure to appear if I forget to take my multivitamin, and it's pretty much constant. Now, Marie, that sounds so much like vitamin D deficiency, I can't tell you how important it is to get a vitamin D level done as soon as possible. You may be getting that bone and deep aching because of low vitamin D levels, and of course that is going to be in the winter. We'll go on to say that she had very borderline concerns for low thyroid, found someone to treat her. Her energy improved, but she lost a lot of weight and dropped down to below 100 pounds, which puts her in a danger zone for her BMI. Then she started being accused of being anorexic by doctors, so she had to gain a lot of weight before they would believe her. Now she's at a normal BMI, but her periods still haven't started. So in terms of your periods, Marie, there are two reasons that people can lose their periods. One of them is primary failure of either the pituitary gland or the ovaries. In the case of assessing that, you would want to get an follicle-stimulating hormone test, or an FSH, and an LH. And you would also want to check your estrogen as estradiol, estrone, and estriol, progesterone. And these would tell you if you have primary ovarian failure, which can happen. I'd also throw in a prolactin, even though you tested negative before, just to make sure that that's still negative. As the treatment for that is easy. You just throw in a prolactin antagonist and everything comes back online. Secondary ovarian failure can certainly be due to calorie restriction. It can be due to low body fat. And so getting a a body impedance analysis or BIA test to see how much body fat you've got, since weight is not a good indicator of that, would tell a lot. Generally, if you have body fat less than 16%, you will not have a period because you simply don't have enough juice to grow an embryo. Malnutrition is a fabulous birth control because the body knows better than to let that malnourished woman get pregnant. She doesn't have what it takes to nourish and feed a fetus. So that's your workup, and I'm sure it will be helpful for other people who are looking in that direction. This to Patricia in Capitola. Patricia wants to know about cholesterol agent red yeast rice or red rice yeast, but it's generally red yeast rice. That's the correct way of putting it. And she read in the Berkeley Wellness letter that one shouldn't take it if you're using levothyroxine. So I went and did a search. I searched the American Council of Science and Health, which is actually a very anti-nutritional website and has every remote, tentative, diffuse potential interaction between nutritionals and drugs that I've ever seen, and they didn't list it. I also looked at drugs.com, and they didn't list it. I am not sure what the Berkeley Wellness letter was based on. I suspect it may simply have been based on a concern that the thyroxine dose could be altered by absorption into the nutritional. So the idea being that if you take this red yeast rice at the same time that you take your thyroxine, that you might not absorb the full dose. And indeed, thyroxine should be taken on an empty stomach about 15 to 20 minutes on either side of eating for exactly that reason. And we're going now to Sally in Santa Cruz. Hello, Sally. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Dawn.
Hello.
Thank you so much for your program and for all the information you give us. It's absolutely wonderful. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
My question is about the Alexander technique. I heard something on NPR about this earlier this week, and I don't know if you're familiar with it, but my question was if you were, and if it was something that you recommend.
Is this an exercise form? I'm not familiar with it.
It is an exercise form. The people in Britain that are working on it said that they had done a controlled study where they found that something like 600 patients with chronic or recurrent low back pain. They randomized them. Some went into normal care, some went into massage, and some went into six Alexander Technique lessons.
And these are exercises that...
It seems like it's a combination of touch guidance, where they look at posture, how people lift chairs and mm-hmm. boxes and so on, how they sit, how they walk. So it's light touch to maybe wake up or activate the muscles, and then a series of prescribed exercises.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like a very plausible way to try and reprogram the sort of reflex mechanisms. The difficulty one might have with the scientific study you mentioned is that I would like to see it head-to-head against, say, McKenzie exercises or some of the other eponymous techniques that are out there.
Say something about the McKenzie exercises.
They were elaborated 20 or 30 years ago by a physical therapist named Robin McKenzie. You can find them if you search that.
Mm-hmm.
And basically they were shown to be effective for low back pain, and there were controlled studies. But again, you know, the idea of a placebo or a control when you're talking about a physical thing
mm-hmm.
is really different. I mean, placebos make sense when you're talking about a drug or maybe an herb therapy. But we've gotten this into this headspace where it has to be placebo-controlled. But how do you do placebo physical therapy?
Mm-hmm.
Do you do incorrect physical therapy so that the people still feel like they're getting physical therapy? Because obviously the difference between an active exercise program and massage is going to be, you know, pretty fundamental. So I don't think too much of the way they did their validation study. On the other hand, I think that physical therapy and postural retraining are excellent ways to help chronic low back pain. So I'm not dissing the Alexander technique per se,
mm-hmm.
but I am saying that they really wanted to get me recommending it. They'd have to prove that they were better than the standard physical therapy exercises that are currently done.
Right. They compare it to something that they call massage therapy.
Right, which is completely different.
Okay.
And so, you know, you've got to be better than the state of the art before I would get too impressed or pay too much money
mm-hmm.
to go and get six Alexander Technique lessons.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what my reply is on it. I am not familiar with it, but even if I were familiar with it, I think my response would be the same.
The McKenzie exercises, have you found those to be convincing?
Yes,
I have.
But that's just in clinical practice without any kind of comparison group. And remember, most people will recover from their low back pain and then re-injure themselves down the line and have another bout of low back pain. So since that's the natural history, you have to do better than the natural history.
Right.
And I think looking at intervals between recurrences is probably the best informal marker for whether or not you're helping the person in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
If they're relapsing once every 6 weeks, whenever they vacuum the floor, and then they're relapsing once every 5 months, when they carried a lot of luggage, then I think they're probably improving with their back exercises.
Mm-hmm.
And core exercises, strengthening those back muscles, is key for low back pain. So both abdominal work and extension work are important.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Great.
Hope
Thank you
helped.
So much.
Thank you very much for the call, Sally.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're talking now to Erin in Seaside. Hello, Erin, and welcome to the program.
Hi.
So
I'm not calling about anything really amazing or startling, just a kind of general health question that I'm an active, healthy 31-year-old woman, and I'm just noticing that I pretty consistently have kind of swollen ankles, and I feel like kind of like I'm retaining a lot of water, and like puffy eyes and under eye area, and I just notice that's kind of consistent no matter what I eat. And I'm just wondering, and I don't think I have any medical problems, but I'm just wondering if there's some kind of general recommendations for something I could think about doing.
Okay, well, let me ask you, do varicose veins run in your family?
Not that I know of.
And do you have any allergies or hay fever?
Yeah, I'm allergic to, I have kind of low-grade allergies.
All right.
I'd say.
Okay, so generalized puffiness in a young person, which, you know, you are, in a background of having allergies are what we call a TH2 sensitivity, would make me wonder if you're having a type 3 hypersensitivity reaction, which means immune complexes forming. And I don't know if you caught the first part of the show when we were talking about autoimmune disease.
Yeah.
But the immunoglobulins that are circulating in your bloodstream that are made by the B cells are just little proteins floating around. And if they encounter something that they can react to, they react and form a clump called an immune complex. And these immune complexes are still fairly small, and they are just big enough to get clogged in the capillaries. And so they will form particles that get into the capillaries, and from there they pass into the interstitial circulation and come out through the lymph glands. And in the process of that, they slow down the lymphatic drainage. And so that leads to a kind of puffiness. Two ways that you could approach this. One of which is you could go on an elimination diet for a couple of weeks, say 3 or 4 weeks, and watch your weight and also watch the puffiness and see if you see a change. And then reintroduce foods one at a time and track your eye puffiness and your ankle puffiness. And typically when you reintroduce after having avoided a food, you'll eat a little bit. And if you don't notice anything, you'll eat a lot the next day and then kind of hang out for a few days and see if you puff up. And then if you puff up, it's like, okay, that's a food I have to avoid. I personally have self-diagnosed, but also validated by blood testing, immune complex disease against soy, which is probably GMO soy, but I've been trying to eat a healthy diet for 30 years, so I've eaten a lot of tofu and a lot of tempeh and a lot of soy milk for a while until I discovered this. It's like, okay, I have to watch it. And there's so many delicious soy things around that sometimes I overdo it, and Yeah, I feel it. I feel a little heavier, and I get the puffiness, and I also get a little itchy, and I get myself.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, and I just kind of don't feel, my tummy just doesn't feel quite right, and it fades in a day or two because I'm otherwise healthy and my body clears the stuff, and,
right.
You know, that's that. But I suspect that might be the answer, and that's a functional medicine answer, by the way. That is not a conventional medicine answer.
Right.
Although, if you go into an immunology textbook, you will read about immune complexes, and you will read about this stuff. Conventional medicine just hasn't put two and two together between the basic science and the clinical manifestations, and it's just, oh, well, that's just another woman who, you know, is complaining about being fat, which I know you're not, by the way, so please.
Right. No, it's fine. I totally follow what your tangent or your direction. Would this be something that would work with like an antihistamine as well, or is it sort of a different
kind of immune response?
Okay.
Antihistamines work for type 1. There's four types of hypersensitivity. So this is type 3.
Okay.
And type 2 is the one you get from a mosquito bite or a contact dermatitis where it's T-cell mediated. And then type 4 is organ rejection. So that's the natural killer cells coming after you.
Okay.
All right.
That's very helpful. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay, cheers.
Let's talk to Teresa in Santa Cruz. Hello, Teresa. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Let's talk about autoimmunity again.
All right.
Okay, and I actually was tested for tissue transglutaminase in 2007.
Did they check for IgG or IgA?
IgG.
Okay, go ahead.
And, but at that time, I had dramatically reduced my intake of all wheat products and any grain associated with it. And so just recently, I kind of prompted a doctor, I had to prompt pretty hard to retest for this. She said, well, you don't have the signs of celiac disease because you don't have irritable bowel syndrome.
Exactly.
So from my reading, it shows there's a great article in 2009 Scientific America that only 50% of the people will show IBS with celiac.
That's
and
right.
So she did test, and sure enough, there we are. I have it. And so what I'm concerned about is the little zonulin that goes in there and disrupts the tight juncture in those endothelial cells, and the concern that it perhaps disrupted a tight juncture that is in my blood-brain barrier and also in the endothelial cells in my vascular system, because I have problems in both those areas.
Mm.
And what I want to know is what I can do to tighten those tight junctures up again.
Well, I actually have an answer for you.
Before
I give it, though, I want to give a little background to the audience so that it won't come across as total gibberish. What we're talking about here is we're talking about gluten sensitivity and the fact that people with frank celiac disease are just the tip of the iceberg, and that a lot of people show reactivity to gluten antigen. And sometimes that stranger danger signal thing I was talking about at the top of the hour gets triggered, and they will start forming antibodies against their own tissues. And that's tissue transglutaminase being one of the common ones that is a barcode very similar to gliadin, which is the breakdown product of gluten. So basically, you eat the gluten, you make gliadin out of it. The gliadin plus some sort of danger signal are picked up by the dendrite cells. They show it to a naive T cell, which becomes sensitized to the gliadin. But because of the similarity between the anti-gliadin and the anti-tissue transglutaminase, you start attacking epithelial surfaces and you injure the tight junctions, which are the Velcro connections between the cells that keep things from creeping between the cells, which is an important thing because lipid-soluble things go into the cells and get detoxified or allowed to pass through, but water-soluble things don't. So if you create a leak between those lipid-soluble walls, water-soluble things can get through and wreak all kinds of havoc, including compounds that are intoxicants getting into the brain and causing brain fog and memory problems. These are all established statements that I can back up with gazillion references if someone challenges me. So I feel like I'm on very safe ground with all of the statements I've just made. In the case of the tight junctions and the zonulin, this is a protein that's been implicated in the maintenance of tight junctions. vitamin D is a specific strengthener of the tight junctions. So one of the things that you can do specifically that will help with all of your barrier functioning is get the vitamin D levels up to, let's say, anything below 75. So, you know, 50 to 75, 25 hydroxy vitamin D levels. And once you're there, you're doing a great deal for that. The other thing you can do for the intestinal barrier functioning is probiotics, which release compounds. And these are also tissue surface markers. So these are those glycoprotein barcodes, but there are other glycoproteins that act as actual signals. And so these are signals that get to the immune system and calm it down and take away the danger signal. So if you've got activated dendritic cells, they've already got the danger signal going. They're just waiting for a stranger to come along to be stimulated. You reduce the danger signal input, you reduce the stranger danger activation of the rest of the immune system and dampen down the cascade. So probiotics and also glutamine, which helps the enterocytes rebuild themselves and therefore strengthens that barrier functioning.
Okay, that sounds good. And I had talked to you previously about how my vitamin D level was tanked down very low, even though I was taking 10,000 international units a day. And you did suggest that an inflammatory process. And so obviously this is an inflammatory process, and I just have to work harder at my vitamin D.
And you may have an absorption problem, because vitamin D is absorbed by the small intestine. And if you have enough injury to the small intestine, that's where celiac disease actually occurs. So if you have a subtle injury there that's impairing your absorption, you may have trouble getting the vitamin D in, and you may have to resort to the 15 minutes three times a week in a tanning bed. But you work up to that, okay? You don't do tanning beds lightly because of the skin cancer risk. And you do a minimum erythematous dose, which means your skin gets pink, but it's not pink the next day. It's just a little pink when you finish. And by that night, that pinkness has gone away. That might be a better way for you to bypass your damaged epithelium.
Yeah, I'm still working on having treated Bartonella with long-term antibiotics and being sun sensitive. So I'm kind of at that little sticky point, but I'll get there.
Well, but I think if you just go really low doses,
okay,
and work your way up. The other thing to do is, did I tell you about checking a 1.25 vitamin D level?
That's right. We just did that test, and the results should be in soon.
All right. If that's elevated, then your primary problem is you're absorbing the vitamin D, but it's getting hyperconverted to the 1.25.
Okay.
And so with that one, if that's what's going on, you're going to have to target the inflammation with large doses of anti-inflammatories. You may end up even having to bypass the oral level and go to inhaled or intravenous drips of things. And that's getting off into serious alternative land. And you can't do that without a good alternative practitioner.
Okay. And with the probiotics, I'm searching for a very broad spectrum probiotic. You know, you can buy them in the market and they have maybe 8 substances in them. And I'm wondering if there's a product out there that really gets some of the little esoteric ones that we just might need offered on the
market. I'm not sure, honestly, I'm not sure how probiotics work. I used to think that it was simply reseeding the lawn, you know, putting them in and they would grow. Scientifically, that doesn't seem to be exactly what's going on. There may be other factors, like I said, substances that are carried in the cell walls that are part of the clinical benefit. That being said, I would send you to Claire Laboratories, KLAIR. And where are you located here in Santa Cruz, Teresa?
Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm. All right. If you will email me at the AskDrDawn.com site where it says contact us, if you'll contact me, I will send you a code that will allow you to purchase from ProThera. Claire Laboratories is one of their subsidiaries, and they have the broadest spectrum, everything under the sun probiotic form that I've found.
Okay.
So that would be the source.
And
they don't sell to health food stores. They only go through practitioners, by the way, which high-end stuff, because when it's really high-end, they, I think, feel it's too expensive to try to sell that compared to all of the low-end stuff that's in the stores. They market it to professionals who are going to be advising patients and can look at the science and say, okay, this is clearly a superior product.
All right. I really appreciate this. And now that I know how many people do have celiac disease, I'm just wondering why all the children aren't tested right before they go into school.
Well, because medical practice is, on the average, about 20 years behind the science. And that has to do with the fact that, you know, doctors are drinking from the fire hose in medical school and in their residency training. And most of them get really burnt out on the literature and on keeping up. And it's really hard to stay caught up in anything but your own field. And the fields are siloed. They're very isolated. So a kind of step back and take a big picture look is something that physicians, it isn't facilitated for them unless they're a functional medicine doctor like myself. So they just don't get it. And it's too hard to learn all of this on your own. I pay probably on the order of $10,000 a year in educational cost just to stay up, not even up. I wouldn't even say I'm up on this. I am halfway climbing this huge mountain of data, halfway to understanding it, but halfway is a long way from my more conventional colleagues in terms of having a systems understanding of these things. So it's hard. That's why it doesn't diffuse quickly, is because
we appreciate your effort. We appreciate your effort there. And thank you so much for your answers.
You're very welcome, and thank you for listening.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We have time for a couple quick emails before the end of the program. Quick one from Peggy in Portland, Maine, wants to know about taking CoQ10 with a statin. Is it necessary? And absolutely, I believe it is necessary to take CoQ10 with any kind of statin, and I would include red yeast rice with that. Also, in terms of CoQ10 wet or dry, there's oily yellow CoQ10, and that is the best absorbed. Also, I might add, you can get a CoQ10 level, and if a person is really wanting to be scientific, they should get their CoQ10 levels checked before they start a statin and then measured after they are on the statin and whatever form of CoQ10 they choose to use to make sure that they have kept that level up where it was before they started the statin. Let's go to a related one from Francis in Carmel, who is 74 and has been given simvastatin for high cholesterol. And he's got very poor sleep. But before we do that, by all means, Francis, get on some CoQ10. In Francis's case, he lists what he's taking for his insomnia: melatonin, valerian, skullcap, chamomile, passionflower, inositol, L-taurine, and 30 milligrams of temazepam with B12. But that only gets him 6 hours with one bathroom break. So, Francis, I think on the subject of your insomnia, it's important for you to engage in some sleep hygiene. That means get it very, very dark. You need to be sure that you really work that body clock. And that means no bright lights, not even television or computer lights for a couple of hours before bedtime. If you can read by candlelight or large print, okay, but turn that screen way, way down. Blackout curtains, no light in the mornings, and the same time of getting up and getting your face immediately in bright light every day. We've come to the end of another hour, and I want to thank you so much for listening and encourage you to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. Those buttons are on the Ask Dr. Don website. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy. Coming up in just a few minutes, we have the news, and after that, Geek Speak.